I think it's appropriate to do some places where we try to maintain natural population levels of both predators and prey.
Park Service officials want to keep Obama-era restrictions on predator hunting in the state. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a four-day session at UAF seeks to help preserve dying Alaska Native languages.
There's a process we need to bring our communities through to take back our right to speak and promote and teach our own Indigenous languages.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
The Trump administration is trying to erase another part of President Obama's environmental legacy in Alaska. It wants to overturn a National Park Service ban on several controversial methods of killing bears and wolves. The methods include luring bears with bait, taking wolves during the denning season, and shining a spotlight into dens to shoot black bears. The methods are legal under state law, but the Park Service has objected to them for years. Jim Adams is Alaska Director of the National Parks Conservation Association, and he likes the Obama-era restrictions.
You know, the state of Alaska has 100 million acres of its own land. It manages hunting regulations on BLM land, Fish and Wildlife Service land. I think it's appropriate to do some places where we try to maintain natural population levels of both predators and prey.
This boils down to a conflict between the National Park Service and the state on the purpose of wildlife management. The goal of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is sustained yield for human hunters. So the state has adopted lethal methods of predator control to bolster moose and caribou numbers. The Park Service, on the other hand, has a policy against killing predators to improve hunting opportunities. The Trump administration's proposal acknowledges that policy, but says the 2015 rule went too far by assuming the state's intent in expanding the methods of predator hunting was to suppress predator populations rather than meet public demand for harvesting wolves and bears. Rod Arno is director of the Alaska Outdoor Council, which supports intensive predator management. He says he's happy to see the start of the process to undo the Obama administration rule.
But it's not, you know, it still doesn't preclude in the future, you know, the same type of rulemaking by the Park Service.
Arno says Congress may have to pass an amendment to clarify the state's authority to manage fish and game throughout Alaska. The proposed rule change was published today in the Federal Register. The Interior Department will accept comments for 60 days. Alaska U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski raised the issue of sexual assaults involving minors on military bases during a Senate Defense Appropriations hearing last week.
Investigators released a total of 8 cases at Alaska installations, 5 of them reportedly at Fort Wainwright. So, of course, this certainly gets your attention.
Senator Murkowski asked U.S. Army Secretary Mark Esper about how youth-on-youth assaults are handled. Esper responded that the Army conducts an initial investigation, but current protocol requires cases to be handed off to local, state, or federal authorities for prosecution.
We have some authority, but it's mainly administrative. So what we can do is we could bar that kid from being on post, or we could remove the family from the post. But beyond that, the authorities really reside outside the military to do that. And I think that's something we need to take a look at.
Esper says the Army's focus is providing victim and family support services. The Walker administration wants stronger penalties for drug manufacturers who don't do enough to curb opioid abuse. Along with 37 other attorneys general, Alaska's Jana Lindemuth signed on to a letter sent to Senate committee leaders urging them to expedite passage of the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act 2.0, sponsored by Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman. The bipartisan bill continues funding for evidence-based prevention, treatment, and recovery programs connected to the national opioid crisis. Within the legislation is a provision modeled on a separate bill introduced by Democratic Senators Maria Cantwell of Washington and Kamala Harris of California. It would increase financial penalties on companies that ignore or fail to report unusual prescription patterns that signal misuse, abuse, and resale of painkillers. The Attorney General letter faults companies that manufacture powerful opioids for past instances of not heeding concerns about overprescribing, illegal sales, and rampant abuse when they are raised. Under the proposed law, companies that don't report suspicious sales activity would see the civil fine increase tenfold to $100,000 and criminal violations for improperly reporting data double to $500,000. Governor Bill Walker sent along his own letter to senators urging them to pass both pieces of legislation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, debunking a common misconception on where oil comes from.
I have had to correct school teachers in the past who have been teaching their kids that oil comes from dinosaurs.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Federal prosecutors have filed court documents in which an Alaska man agrees to plead guilty to a Florida airport shooting rampage that killed five people and wounded six last year. The agreement, filed today, says that 28-year-old Esteban Santiago will plead guilty to 11 of the 22 counts against him. Prosecutors reached a deal with Santiago's defense lawyers not to seek the death penalty in exchange for the guilty plea. Instead, Santiago would serve a life prison sentence. The deal is expected to be finalized Wednesday in court. The mentally troubled Santiago of Anchorage acknowledged in the document that he flew to Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport with a handgun in a checked weapons box in January of 2017. Santiago loaded the gun in a bathroom and came out firing. Alaska Native languages are the focus of a four-day institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks this week. The Alaska Native Language Revitalization Institute is hosted by the UAF College of Rural and Community Development. College Director of Indigenous Programs Sandra Kowalski says the conference reflects a new urgency to preserve Alaska's diversity of Native languages.
Recently, the legislature passed a resolution declaring that our Alaska Native languages are in a state of emergency. In addition to that, just in recent years, we've seen an increased interest by young people to become second language speakers.
Kowalski says the institute will focus on 10 of Alaska's 20 native languages, including five from the interior region. She says participants will explore strategies for learning and teaching language from Alaska and outside experts.
From Hawaii, where they've got strong revitalization efforts underway, and from some experts with the Mohawk language, they've been able to produce proficient second language Mohawk speakers.
Kowalski notes that UAF's Alaska Native Language Center has documented the state's indigenous languages, a valuable baseline of information. Kowalski stresses this week's institute is also about empowering people.
There's this sense that that we have to ask and be given permission to be who we are. And there's a process we need to bring our communities through to take back our right to speak and promote and teach our own indigenous languages.
Kowalski says the response to the Alaska Native Language Revitalization Institute has been strong and registration is full. More than 150 people have signed up. An affiliate of the German-based industrial giant Siemens is offering to build an LNG plant near Wasilla and transport the gas it processes there to Fairbanks at no cost to the Interior Gas Utility if the IGU Board of Directors agrees to a long-term LNG sales contract. Officials with the Siemens Government Technologies outlined the proposal to the IGU board during a special meeting last week. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
IGU board chairwoman Pam Troop says there's a lot to like about the Siemens government technology proposal, but she says it all comes down to helping the IGU
get cheap gas real soon so we can get conversions immediately and start building.
Siemens proposes to bring natural gas to Fairbanks from a plant it would build near Wasilla by the end of next year at a price that's about the equivalent of $2 per gallon heating oil, the price point IGU officials say it must attain to attract enough customers to convert from oil to gas heat to make the project viable.
And the other thing that I think is really, really attractive about Siemens is bringing in other users, big users, possibly military, hospital, university.
Troop says the Siemens plan would enable the IGU to avoid cost overruns it may encounter in buying and refurbishing the aging Pentex Alaska gas liquefaction plant at Port McKenzie that the IGU plans to buy from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority.
Any cost overruns have to be absorbed by us. Therefore, they will affect the price of the gas at the end of the day. And I have a huge concern about that. I also have a huge concern about us running a plant that's 300 miles away.
The Siemens plant would be built in increments based on demand on land owned by Knik Atnu, a local Alaska Native village corporation that Siemens is partnering with on the project. Using that facility would save IGU from having to incur bond debt to expand the Pentex plant to meet future demand. Instead, it would become the backup for the Siemens facility. Troop also likes Siemens' plan to use Alaska Railroad cars to transport gas instead of the trucks that Pentex uses to deliver to its subsidiary, Fairbanks Natural Gas.
And I also am concerned about having a lot of trucks on the highway to serve all the customers that we're supposed to be getting. I would much rather that gas be on the railroad.
The Siemens officials declined to comment for this story and referred queries to their corporate headquarters. Troop says her concerns over the proposal include Siemens's projections that show the natural gas retail price rising over the next several years to a level that's higher than the $2 a gallon heating oil equivalent. But overall, she's inclined to support the proposal, and she says some of her fellow board members are too. All had questions at Tuesday's meetings, and so did Gary Wilkin, a former state lawmaker from Fairbanks who now sits on the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority Board of Directors. ADA's board also would have to approve Siemens' proposal. Wilkin says it would have to offer the certainty of bringing in gas at the lowest price possible, as he says ADA's plan does.
The Siemens challenge is to bring the certainty that we have with our other proposal to the table to decide whether it is indeed a viable one.
Wilkin says he and the other ADA board members haven't had a chance to fully review Siemens's proposal. He says ADA officials will do that and will be especially mindful of its impact on keeping prices low for IGU customers.
Our focus is the family on Badger Road, the meter price, and everything else you want to talk about is just detail.
Troop says the IGU board must decide whether to accept Siemens' proposal by May 29th in Fairbanks. I'm Tim Ellis.
The Alaska Marine Highway System got what it asked for in the legislature's operating budget. Lawmakers okayed the system's request in their spending plan for the next fiscal year, which begins July 1st. General Manager Captain John Falvey says the budget funds an eight-week increase in service.
That gives us about 345.9 weeks, a little bit more technically than last year because of different ship configurations. Some ships are more expensive or not than others to run. So it gives us a nice mix for the upcoming year.
The Marine Highway faced a shutdown in April due to a lack of money. A budget provision diverted ferry funding to cover Medicaid program shortfalls. But Governor Bill Walker replaced that money in a supplemental budget request, and the legislature approved it. As prices and demand for Pacific halibut have fallen in Alaska, commercial fishermen say a new Canadian competitor is to blame. Since 2012, Canadian imports of fresh Atlantic halibut have grown roughly 60%. As the Canadian catch continues to grow, fishermen in New England are working toward restarting a fishery in U.S. waters. KBBI's Aaron Bolton reports that could have a serious effect on Alaska's halibut industry.
Atlantic halibut seems to have been on the tip of the commercial fishing industry's tongue in Alaska as imports from Canada continue to carve out a significant slice of the New England fresh halibut market. Prices on the docks in Alaska have fallen about $2 per pound, and there's a surplus of halibut in the freezer from last year that isn't selling. Doug Bowen works with Alaska Boats and Permits, a vessel and fishing permit broker in Homer. Bowen and others in the industry say both are a result of Pacific halibut losing out to Canadian fish.
So it's kind of a new world order here in the ex-vessel prices, and maybe something that we're going to be dealing with for some time.
But Alaska's fishing industry is not the only one noticing the growth of the Canadian Atlantic halibut fishery.
You know, a lot of those boats are fishing on the U.S.-Canadian line and having very good results here, and it's been going on for quite a while. And frankly, New England fixed gear boats are missing out on this opportunity.
Mike Russo is a New England-based commercial fisherman, and he's been trying to strum up support for an industry halibut longline survey in U.S. waters. Russo says the Atlantic halibut Canadian fishermen are catching are the same fish U.S. fishermen are seeing more of as they target other species.
Somebody's going to make us prove it, but I believe that's what will bear out. You know, those fish don't know political lines in the ocean on a chart.
Information on Atlantic halibut stocks in the U.S. is minimal. There are no extensive abundance surveys, and federal fishery managers don't actively manage the stock as a commercial fishery. Fishermen are only allowed one fish per trip as bycatch. Chris McGuire works with the Nature Conservancy in Massachusetts, which is trying to collect information on the valuable bottom fish. He's been working with fish biologists and management officials to see if what U.S. fishermen like Russo are saying is in fact true.
We're working with commercial fishermen to do biological sampling of halibut to determine age and size at maturity. We're doing some DNA sampling from that. And then in a separate part of that project, we're doing a little bit of pop-up satellite tagging to figure out where the fish that we see off of New England go over the course of a whole year.
McGuire is working with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada to satellite tag the fish, which will help determine whether Atlantic halibut on both sides of the border should be treated as one stock, which is how Pacific halibut are managed by the International Pacific Halibut Commission. Richard McBride is a fisheries biologist with NOAA Fisheries Greater Atlantic Regional Office. McBride teamed up with McGuire and New England fishermen to collect biological samples from the halibut they're catching.
I mean, if we're really to manage them as a renewable resource, we want fish to spawn at least once in a quality way and maybe more times have the potential to spawn more than once. And then that's the kind of thing that helps really accelerate the rebuilding.
All of the fervor around Atlantic halibut could be another significant blow to Alaska fishermen and fish buyers who have historically controlled the market on the East Coast. But both McBride and McGuire say it could be another 5 to 10 years before U.S. fishery managers have enough information to start an Atlantic halibut fishery. Still, those in the Alaskan fishing industry, like Andy Wink, a fisheries analyst, say depending on how things shake out, a U.S. Atlantic halibut fishery could maintain that new world order the Alaska fishing industry is currently coping with.
I guess the question there is whether it adds total supply or not. If they essentially get a cut of the Canadian halibut fishery, it's a domestic fishery, so it's, you know, much more likely to go domestic, but it doesn't have nearly the impact as if you're talking about adding tack onto the Canadian tack.
If scientists find that Atlantic halibut along the East Coast belong to one stock, setting up an internationally managed fishery in U.S. waters could push the process down the road. And Wink says even if New England fishermen are able to start fishing in 5 years, the Alaska fishing industry's more immediate concern is still the growing number of truckloads of Atlantic halibut from Canada currently moving across the border. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state. Seasonal summer routes now available to Cordova, Anchorage, and Valdez. Information available at flyraven.com. ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
It's been 75 years since thousands of young soldiers lost their lives fighting over the westernmost point of the United States, and 75 years since the Alaska Native people of Attu were taken from their homes, never to return again. This week, former Attu residents, as well as veterans of the Aleutian Campaign and descendants of the Japanese soldiers, joined together to commemorate the tragedy and honor the legacy of those lost. KUCB's Zoe Sobel was there.
In war, no one walks away unscathed. The Battle of Attu was no exception. But 75 years after one of the deadliest battles fought on North American soil, representatives from all affected parties joined together to ensure this history is never forgotten. The closing ceremony was held in an airplane hangar at the Alaska Aviation Museum. While the Aleutian Campaign is not well known and often called the Forgotten War, Mayor Crystal Dushkin says that's not true for her.
I'm here to tell you that for our people, the Unaq people of the Aleutian Islands, and those descendants of the people of Attu, it has never been forgotten, and it never will be.
Dushkin's grandmother, Mary Snigaroff, was born on Attu and later moved to Atka. 42 Attu residents were taken to Japan and held as prisoners of war. Nearly half died of malnutrition and starvation. After the war, the U.S. government would not allow them to return home to their island. Unanga from other Aleutian communities were rounded up by the federal government and placed in internment camps in southeast Alaska. Dushkin says during World War II, Unanga were caught in a crossfire between the U.S. and Japan.
It was not our fight to begin with. Not our battle, not our war. Yet our people suffered immeasurably, both at the hands of the Japanese and at the hands of the U.S.
Dushkin hopes that the commemoration can help ensure the Aleutian Campaign does not continue to be the forgotten war in Japan or in America. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Bob Brocklehurst agrees. He was the first fighter pilot on Attu, but he didn't learn about what happened to the Unungan people until last year. He wants the documentary film When the Fog Clears, which premiered at the commemoration, to be widely distributed. It showed him that the opposing Japanese soldiers weren't any different from him.
The film showed the Japanese with the same love for family, the same worries about their son in combat, in army units or whatever, and the same respect that the son in uniform had for his wife and family back home. Exactly identical to an American family.
Motoaki Asano came from Japan to attend the commemoration. His father, Hiro-o Okazaki, died on Attu and is still buried there alongside more than 2,000 other Japanese soldiers. He spoke through a translator.
My
father's body is still on Attu, so I would like to bring him back as soon as possible.
Asano says he learned about the suffering the Attu people endured during World War II and is honored to work to make sure future generations never forget the forgotten war.
Some people in Japan are just looking forward the future and they try not to go back to the past. So I have to work hard to keep this memory alive.
This request to return the Japanese soldiers' remains to Japan has been made of the Japanese government three times. Returning the remains would be complicated, but Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge manager Steve Delahanty says not impossible. And after the closing ceremonies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service got their own request from Attu descendant Helena Schmitz.
I want my children's children to be able to go back to Attu with no cost to us.
and that's the justice that needs to be done on our people. The U.S. government, the Japanese government, and the Russian government took our culture away, and we need your help since you guys own the island.
Schmidt says while the return trip last summer was an important step, it was not enough. Principal Deputy Director Greg Sheehan said he didn't know what the options are, but he said he's open to talking more about the idea. In Anchorage, I'm Zoe Sobel.
And now to a pretty basic question about oil that a lot of people get wrong. Does it come from dinosaurs? From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has the answer.
First, how would you answer? I pose this question to people in Fairbanks. True or false? Oil comes from dinosaurs.
True.
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 I would say true.
That's Elena Rachel, Max Kay, Kathy McFarland, and Sammy McFarland. Props to them for being willing to be wrong on the radio, because...
The short answer is no, oil is not made from dinosaurs.
Zach Lyons is a geologist with the Oil and Gas Division at the Bureau of Land Management, Alaska.
Oil actually originates from plants and tiny marine organisms that sink down to the ocean floor and are buried over the course of millions of years.
The plants and critters Lyons is talking about are tiny. Most are only visible through a microscope. Little by little, over millions of years, these creatures died and piled up at the bottom of the sea, mixing with mud and sand to form layers that could be tens of thousands of feet thick. And through a particular formula of heat, pressure, lack of oxygen, and hundreds of millions of years, that marine sludge became oil. So why do so many people have the impression that we're loading up our gas tanks with giant ancient reptiles?
I have tried to trace the history of this, and I think it largely goes back to the Sinclair Oil Company.
That's Kenneth Lacquavera, a paleontologist. You probably know Sinclair Oil by their logo, a big green brontosaurus-looking dinosaur. Sinclair never actually claimed that oil came from dinosaurs, but the creatures became central to their marketing, starting back in the 1930s. But can one company single-handedly create that kind of association?
Dinosaurs, I think, in the public imagination, stand in for the ancient. And dinosaurs are, of course, known to us as fossils, and oil is called a fossil fuel. And so I think it's easy for people to make the connection in their minds.
Lacquavera says that connection runs deep. It's a misconception he's still working to correct.
I speak to school groups quite frequently, and I have had to correct school teachers in the past who have been teaching their kids that oil comes from dinosaurs.
So if oil doesn't come from the dinosaurs that died out millions of years ago, what does that mean for the future of oil? Could it be replenished hundreds of millions of years down the line? The answer is maybe. The conditions that made all that oil possible, a much warmer climate that encouraged explosive growth of those little marine critters, we just don't see that now at the same scale.
So while we are producing the raw material today that could later be turned into petroleum by geological processes, we're probably not producing them as fast now as 100 million years ago.
In other words, we don't see the conditions on Earth today that would lead to the replication of the oil we've used up. But geologic time is a lot longer than human time. You never know what might happen in several hundred million years. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
That's all for tonight. We had reports from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross, Tim Ellis, and Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes and Zoe Sobel in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Aaron Bolton in Homer. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Heroin is an opioid known for risks of addiction and overdose, but prescription opioids such as hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine can also carry these risks. If you're prescribed an opioid for pain, ask your medical provider about the risks and ask about alternative treatments. Learn more about opioid safety at opioids.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.